Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Lost Origins, your number one radio show for all things ancient mystery, alternative historical theory, and lost civilizations. I'm your host, Andrew, and I challenge every single one of you to go check out the website at lost-origins.com, sign up for that newsletter, and keep in touch with us. You guys can also connect with us on social media. We are on almost every single platform. We're super active on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So make sure that you hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode or an article from your friends here at Lost Origins. This week's episode of Lost Origins is brought to you by Worldviews Media. Worldviews has two incredible events coming up later this month in Sedona, Arizona, with none other than our friend Robert Bouval. So this is definitely an event you want to check out. Bouval is going to be speaking at the Sedona Creative Life Center on May 27th. Doors open at 6 p.m. And from May 28th to May 30th, Bouval and Worldview Media will be facilitating day trips through the ancient Southwest. So you're going to be able to check out the Verde Valley ruins, museums, petroglyphs, so much more. But you're going to get to do that while picking Robert Bouval's brain. So an incredible trip you don't want to miss. Head over to worldviewsmedia.com/seminars. Views is spelled V-I-E-W-Z, and secure your tickets. This week's episode of Lost Origins is also brought to you by our good friends over at Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Inner Traditions has been publishing books on esoteric philosophy, New Age spirituality, alternative health, and ancient mysteries for well over 40 years. Check out their website at innertraditions.com. You guys can learn more about their books, authors, sign up for coupons, special offers. These guys know what they're doing. Some of my all-time favorite books surrounding ancient mysteries have come out of Inner Traditions and Baron Company, so we highly recommend that you pick up one of their books. Today, you guys, we finally get to talk Atlantis. You have no idea how pumped I am for that. Not only do we get to talk Atlantis, which is one of my all-time favorite topics and all-time favorite ancient mysteries, but we have the privilege of doing so with one of the most recognized authorities on the subject, Rand Flemmath. Rand comes to us from Vancouver Island, and he has authored several captivating books, including Killing Moses, The Atlantis Blueprint, and most recently, Atlantis Beneath the Ice. Rand's work has expanded upon the Earth crust displacement theory as presented by Charles Hapgood, and today we're going to be discussing not only that theory, but his theory surrounding Antarctica actually having been Atlantis, the disbursement of the Atlantean refugees after the cataclysm, and much more right after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this week's episode of Lost Origins. I'm your host, Andrew, and if you're just tuning in, this week we are joined by author and researcher Rand Flemmath. Rand comes to us from Vancouver Island, and he has authored several books, including Killing Moses, The Atlantis Blueprint, and most recently, Atlantis Beneath the Ice. Today, we get to talk all things Atlantis, and you guys have no idea how excited I am for this conversation. I've done so many episodes of Lost Origins, and I have yet to have the opportunity to geek out over some Atlantis, so today's going to be a blast. So with that, it is my pleasure to welcome Rand Flemmath to this week's episode of Lost Origins. Rand, thank you so much for getting on the horn with us today.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I'm looking forward to it as well. It's nice to have somebody who's actually read the book. Sometimes I do radio interviews and they haven't even done that.
Well, we try to do our research here, you know.
I know that you've read the book, and that makes a big difference.
Good. And you're out, so Vancouver Island. Before we get cranking on Atlantis, I got to say, I've watched the show Alone. I know you and I have talked about a little bit about that via email. That island is just stunning. How are you guys liking living out there?
Well, we've been here a long time, so yeah, we like it here. We love it here. We've recently moved to the further north. We lived sort of midway for a lot of the time, but now we're in the north now, and it's beautiful here.
That's awesome. I bet it's an incredible experience. I mean, watching it on the show, it's just, it looks like just such an incredible, incredible location. So that's awesome. So before we...
Well, we want everybody to come here. It's a nice place to visit. It's a beautiful place. And if you're a camper or something, you can't get better than this. And fishing as well.
Sure. Well, now with Histories alone, you have all the survival tips that you need to brave the Vancouver wilderness. So,
yeah.
Rand, before we dig into all things Atlantis, I do want to get a bit of your background. I always find it fascinating to hear the story as to how people became intrigued with Atlantis. I feel like Atlantis captivates and captures all of us in a different way when she digs her claws in, right? So I'm definitely interested to find out what intrigued you about Atlantis to the point where you were inspired to author more than one book on the topic.
Well, it originally began, I was... waiting for a job. I'm a librarian. I just finished my Master of Library Science from the University of British Columbia, and I had a job interview in Victoria on Vancouver Island, which is the capital of British Columbia. It's on the southern tip of Vancouver Island, and I needed that job, so I was waiting, and you know, the Donovan show, a song came on about Atlantis, Hail Atlantis, and I was just sort of thinking of doodling some ideas down, and then I decided to go to the library and find out a little bit about Atlantis, because I was just sort of kind of curious. I had no idea about it. I had no idea about it. And through the course of the afternoon at the library, I came across Kirker's map of Atlantis, which was, you probably have, many people have seen it. It's sort of, his interpretation of it is slightly different, but I'll get into that later.
Sure.
Anyway, I got the job, and in the course, one of the things that I did when I was first at the library there was helping books being turned in, and so I get to see all the books, to see the collections, right? And along came Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings by Charles
Hapgood. Sure.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, well, that's kind of interesting, because I was kind of interested in this map and everything. And then I'm looking through, I took that home, and I was looking through it, and I came across a map of Antarctica without the ice. This is the first time I'd ever seen Antarctica without the ice. Normally it's just this big blob on the southern end of our globe, but when you remove the ice, it's actually a major island and a series of other islands. And this looked so reminiscently close to the Kirker map of Atlantis that that made me think, well, say, maybe something's going on here. So, it was a coincidence. It seemed like a coincidence at the time, but then the more I looked into it, and then the more I read Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings by Charles Hapgood, I became convinced that, you know, there were ancient maps of Antarctica in existence before the discovery of Antarctica, which is commonly believed around 1818 or so. The fact that these maps, and the Kirker map in particular, was in print in 1665. So, you know, it's a long time before Europeans had even discovered that there was a continent there. That a lot of the map makers of the old days believed that there was a southern island continent, but that was a hypothetical continent, if you like it. Nobody had ever seen it. So when I discovered that Hapgood had discovered a number of maps of Antarctica, and some of which showed subglacial features of the continent, that made me think, okay, well, this is something worthy of really investigating. And then, of course, I followed up on Hapgood and found out his theory of Earth crust displacement, and that sort of really gave it a lot of impetus. At that point, yeah. So at that point, we decided to I was getting books on the interlibrary loan. It was taking 2 or 3 weeks every time, you know, and there were so many old books that I needed to see to be able to, and being a librarian, I know how to get them, but it still took a lot of time in those days to get books. So we decided to leave Vancouver Island, and we moved to London, England.
Oh, wow.
My wife, Rose, was born in England, so she had dual citizenship.
And okay.
So I could do that, too. And I wanted to use the British Museum Library because that's the second best library in the world. Of course, the first is the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't live in the States, but I could live in London. So then I had access to the whole British Library collection. And books that used to take me weeks to get, I could get in hours.
Right.
So it was just amazing. So we had intended to go there for 6 months to get the research done. We stayed for 4 years, and it was just a fun time.
That's awesome.
We came back here.
It's a cool place. I've been a few times, and I definitely enjoy it. Well, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Okay.
Let's dig into some Plato real quick.
Sure.
In the Timaeus, Plato describes Atlantis as being larger than Libya and Asia combined. And I always find this interesting because this is a huge point of contention and has been for so many years between people trying to prove the existence of Atlantis and those trying to debunk its existence, right? The skeptics always say, how could an island of that size disappear overnight and nobody else knows about it, right? So your theory presents an interesting solution to the problem with respect to where you think Atlantis could be located. Can you speak to that for us, Rand?
Libya and Asia in Greek terms were like North Africa and what we would call the Middle East. So it's a gigantic chunk of land.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it can't be in the Mediterranean Sea because it's like 10 times bigger than the Mediterranean Sea.
Right.
When in Timaeus he says it's beyond the Pillars of Hercules, the Pillars of Hercules is what we call the Strait of Gibraltar today.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond there, for the Greeks, was a place you just didn't go because people who went there didn't come back. So beyond, so the idea that Atlantis was an island continent west of America was just the idea that it was beyond the Pillars of Hercules. But beyond does not mean west. It just means outside of the Mediterranean Sea.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start to look for an island continent, and we are now talking about something the size of Antarctica, you really only have three candidates if it's still around. If it's not around, then that's a different problem. But if it's still around, then there's really only Antarctica, Australia, or Greenland that even comes close, and even Greenland is pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
So then you get into the other descriptions that Plato gives. Actually, it's it's the Egyptian priest Zonkus who's giving these descriptions, and Plato's recording it much later. But he gets into it as being a high-altitude continent,
mm-hmm.
and Antarctica is the highest-altitude continent in the world. And then he got into the description of the location of Atlantis as seen from Atlantis. And that's what really caused the problems for most people, not being able to crack the code, is that they didn't understand that you had to understand the world from the perspective of Atlantis. And that perspective, in our view, is exactly equal to what a U.S. Naval Antarctic Support Force map is of Antarctica, which puts Antarctica in the center of the world, and then the world ocean, and there is only one ocean.
Right.
One continuous ocean, and then the Mediterranean is but a bay, a small bay of that. And this is in the description, too. So the description of the geography of Atlantis, as described from the perspective of Atlantis, which we believe was Antarctica, accurately describes the Earth's geography as seen from Antarctica. So that was then, after the Kircher map, and then the Plato's description, I felt that now it was really worthwhile going in to see how could this happen? How could it happen that Antarctica could become Atlantis? Antarctica was Atlantis, and how Atlantis became Antarctica. And that was where the theory of Earth crust displacement, again, Charles Hapgood, that came to about a year after our research, I got into that, and then started course. My wife Rose and I, started corresponding with Charles Hapgood.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's talk Charles Hapgood real fast then.
Sure.
So Earth crust displacement, I mean, fascinating theory, one that was championed by Albert Einstein himself. Can you give us some insight as to Earth crust displacement theory for our listeners? I want to make sure that everybody's on the same page here, and we all understand kind of basically how it works and how this theory lends itself to Antarctica having been Atlantis.
Sure. Okay, so most people, when they think about geology, they think about plate tectonics, which is the Earth is a series of plates. Some of them are beneath the ocean. Some of them are on the continents. But there's a series of plates, and these plates are moving very gradually in relationship to each other.
Mm-hmm.
This is very, very slow stuff. We're talking about like your hair growing.
Right.
That's how far continents move in a year. What your hair would grow in a year, that's how much the continent could shift.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking really, really slow things. Now, plate tectonics works as a theory, and I have no problem with plate tectonics. People often say that I'm against plate tectonics. I'm not against plate tectonics. I believe plate tectonics is absolutely true for all the problems that it is able to solve. However, there are a set of problems that it can't solve, such as mass extinctions, myths of legends of great floods, the origins of agriculture, all sorts of things that cannot be explained by plate tectonics.
Right.
So now, when we go back to the outer shell of the Earth, and we think of all those plates, now we want to think of them all as just one big shell. Okay, and immediately beneath them, there's an area called the asthenosphere, which means weak zone. And then below that is the mantle, which is quite thick. Think of it like an apple. The flesh of the apple is the mantle. The core has a core. The skin of the apple is the crust.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the difference between that, an apple, or an orange, if we could take it to an orange now, imagine you have an orange, you peel it, but you try to keep it all in one piece,
mm-hmm.
and then you reassemble it on top of the flesh underneath. Now we're talking about that outer shell moving, but the rest of the Earth's planet staying stationary.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only 1/3 of 1% of the Earth's mass that's actually moving. Not the whole Earth, not the axis of the Earth. The axis remains pointing the same direction as it was before the displacement. So what happens in an Earth crust displacement is the whole shell, and this includes the ocean basins as well, don't think of the continents and moving in relationship to each other. It's the whole outer shell moving in relationship to the climatic zone.
Right.
So we have polar zone, temperate zone, tropical zones. So you might be in a temperate zone and end up in a tropical zone.
Right.
Or you might be in a tropical zone and end up in a temperate zone. Worst case is you're in a temperate zone and you end up in a polar zone, and that's what happened to Atlantis. It was in the temperate zone. 1/3 of Antarctica, the part towards South America, was before the displacement of the Earth's crust, was in a temperate zone. And as the Earth's crust shifted, it shifted all the whole continent into the Antarctic Circle, mm-hmm. so it went to polar. And this is interesting because, you know, like, for example, in the Zen Vesta of ancient Iraq, one of the earliest texts written in the world, there's the story of Arianovejo, which was the island paradise of the original Iranians.
Mm-hmm.
They speak of the island paradise where they lived being destroyed in a flood that also was a great blizzard and covered the original homeland in snow and ice. So when you turn to world mythology, you find that it's supporting the idea of Antarctica being recently polarized, mm-hmm. if you like.
How fast are we talking here, Rand? I mean, like if the Earth were to undergo crust displacement, I mean, it does line up with Plato's writings where, I mean, destroyed in a day and night, or is that then at that point part of the myth and the story, you know, interwoven into the narrative?
Well, yeah, the thing, I believe in Plato's text, well, I better answer your question first, which is, we don't know for certain. I have good thought it would took 3 or 4 or 4 even 5,000 years to do. I, on the other hand, after having studied so many myths of the sky falling when the flood occurs, or we call them the sun deluge myths, the mm-hmm. sun veers from its normal place, sky, and because when the crust is shifting, it seems as though the sky is falling. That's why our original book was called When the Sky Fell.
Right.
Now it's Atlantis beneath the ice. The notion that that the Earth's sky is unstable is also part of the Earth crust displacement theory. But so I'm more inclined to think that it's relatively it happens like in a weeks.
Okay.
Not a month, but weeks.
That's fast. I mean,
yeah, relatively fast, because you get people talking about the sky falling. You get people talking about, I mean, indigenous people all over the planet, the sky is falling, or the stars are falling, mm-hmm. or the sun is veering from its normal path. You wouldn't be seeing that if it was taking 5,000 years. You wouldn't
right.
be noticing that. Yeah.
You know, and I also find it very interesting. I mean, another discrepancy, you know, with the story of Solon and Plato is, you know, a lot of people say, well, when it was translated, you know, the numbers were mixed up. It wasn't 9,000 years before the time of Solon. It was 900 years. But what's interesting is among all of the worldwide deluge myths that we have, or stories of them, 9,000 years before the time of Solon conveniently puts us towards the end of the Younger Dryas, which, as we both know, is, you know, the end of the last ice age, a very cataclysmic period where, you know, with the comet impacts, you know, the sky was literally falling. So my question is do we think that Earth crust displacement is triggered by cataclysmic events such as meteor strikes, comets, so on and so forth?
Well, this is, again, something that Einstein and Hapgood discussed extensively, and I've read all that correspondence. And what Einstein, because they came up with different theories, you know, and each one of them Einstein would dismiss for one reason or another.
Sure.
And he wasn't too concerned that you couldn't find a mechanism. He thought it was an important theory to investigate anyway. However, he did say, basically, we're looking for at a steady, it's not something like an impact would do that. An impact is more likely just to, you know, isn't likely to shift the Earth's crust. What you need is something that's happening, a steady force over a certain period of time. And this is where I think that a fellow named Gerard Friedman in Florida, who came up with this theory of solar typhoons, which is the idea that just as the Earth has occasional hurricanes, so over a much longer period of time, the sun has solar typhoons that send out electromagnetic storms that can reach the Earth's orbit. Now, if the Earth's, and this is a perfect circumstances to create under the conditions that Einstein had hypothesized. First of all, it's a steady force. It's continually, and it's hitting because it's an electromagnetic storm, it's hitting the Earth, which itself is a magnet, at one of the poles.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's hitting it at a steady pace. Now, if this continues on for like weeks, imagine a big solar flare that just is continuing on for a long time, and the Earth is coming into the orbit of spattering, if you like, of what's coming from the sun, mm-hmm. it starts to hit the Earth at one of the poles. The energy goes down into the core, heats up the interior, and that comes back up. And then what happens is the asthenosphere, which is this weak zone right below the Earth's crust and above the mantle, it becomes more liquefied because the heat turns. It's like turning tar, making it hot. It starts to become more viscous. It's easy to move. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing that I think probably happened. And then the beauty of the solar typhoon theory for Earth crust displacement is that once you leave the stream of stuff that's coming from the sun, and then everything cools down and everything stops. Because in space, once an action starts, you know, it's difficult to stop it. So what you need here is a cooling effect as well. And so that's how the displacements occurs. And I think that's the best explanation we have right now.
Sure, sure.
Other explanations may yet come.
Yeah. Well, and it's exciting, too, because every day more discoveries are being made, more theories are being developed. And so I always like watching, you know, what's happening in the world of Atlantis. And so it's just interesting to kind of piece it all together. We do have to take a quick break, Brand, but when we come back,
sure.
I want to discuss the Atlantean refugees, because I really, really want to get your take on those refugees having escaped the cataclysm and then where your evidence puts them to reboot civilization. So more from Rand Flemmath right after this. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this week's episode of Lost Origins. I'm your host, Andrew, and if you're just tuning in, this week we are joined by author and researcher Rand Flemmath. Rand is a recognized authority on Atlantis, and this week we are talking all things Atlantis. So before the break, we were discussing Charles Hapgood's theory with respect to Earth crust displacement and how this is indicative of Antarctica actually having been Atlantis. So what we wanted to dig in before the break, Rand, was, you know, obviously we're talking cataclysm, we're talking, you know, all of the solar flares that are actually triggering this Earth crust displacement and moving Antarctica down to the South Pole very rapidly and violently, I would assume.
Yeah, the whole Earth's crust is moving. It just happens to be the part that Atlantis was in is ending up in the polar zone.
Right. So these people obviously had to, you know, adapt or die, so to speak. So these refugees are then disseminating themselves amongst the Earth. So my question for you is, you know, if we look at ancient megalithic sites all over the world, we find staggering similarities. You know, we had Laird Scranton on the show not too long ago, and he has a theory with respect to Göbekli Tepe having served as an ancient megalithic architectural school, which I thought was fascinating, and it makes a lot of sense. But at the same time, it always seems like, you know, if we find evidence of an archaeological style in Peru, for example, and we find that exact same style up in Egypt, it really makes you wonder what's going on here, right? So based on your research, do you think that the Atlanteans kind of congregated at one location to reboot civilization? Do you think that they spread out amongst the world, and maybe that's why we're seeing similarities in ancient architecture? What are your thoughts here, Rand?
Well, I do believe that there was somewhat of a revival. The Atlantis fleet, if you like, might have continued to exist. And here's the reason. We get, and I explained this in the book that I wrote with Colin Wilson called The Atlantis Blueprint, we have a Giza prime meridian. Mm-hmm. Once you make Giza the prime meridian, then all these sites in America, let's start with Tiahuanaco in Lake Titicaca in the central Andes. First of all, this location is midway between the two equators, if you like. The equators don't actually move, it's the crust moving, but it was like 1,500 miles north of the equator, actually. Mm-hmm. As much of North America was in the northern hemisphere before the displacement. And then it turned out to be 1,500 kilometers to south of the equator. So its relationship to the sun was the same as it was both before and after the displacement, with a very favorable location. Mm-hmm. This is where potatoes were domesticated. This is where you get this huge construction of architecture on Lake Titicaca. And it is, Tiahuanaco is 100 degrees west of the Giza. Then you find at Quinto, which is the northern end of the Inca Trail and the other capital of ancient South America. It's on the equator today, but it's 110 degrees west of the Great Pyramid. Then you get three or four places at 120, including Copan, Lubantum, Chichen Itza. Mm-hmm. They're all 120 degrees west of the Great Pyramid. Then you have Tiahuanaco in north of Mexico City with the Pyramid of Sun. It's 130 degrees west. Hmm. And then Easter Island is 140 degrees west. So you've got these sacred sites that are key to a Giza Prime Meridian. So that tells me that people were operating with geographic knowledge that is accurate. The problem that the Atlanteans had, is they didn't know how much the Earth's crust had shifted. So they have to go back to all these places that they've known and then do recalculations. So this is no longer the latitude that we used to be at. This is now a different latitude. They have to, and through that, they are, and also the ocean level is rising. So the coastlines are changing as well. So they have a big mapping project to do to be able to recalibrate what has happened to the Earth. And during this period, they're also, these survivors are also introducing agriculture. The earliest experimentations with agriculture are occurring right at the end of the Ice Age. You know, there are some that before, but there's a great 9,600 BC or 11,600 years ago, if you want to put it that way, there was an explosion of agriculture around the world. Mm-hmm. Agricultural experimentation. Up until that point, very little. You get all sorts of people saying that there's things before nowadays, and that's kind of, you know, a little bit of a competition, you know, like the Chinese want to say they have the oldest one, and they, you know, or it's political. It gets political.
Right.
However, before it was political, because I did do a lot of work on the origins of agriculture, and I published in the scientific literature on the origins of agriculture using the theory of Earth's crust displacement to explain the sudden origins of agriculture. What we find here is that exactly as when at the same century that Atlantis is being destroyed, we're getting Göbekli Tepe appearing in the Middle East, and we're getting agriculture origins occurring all over the world. And they're happening in very specific locations that are all explained by the climatic changes that come as a result of a displacement of the Earth's crust.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, too. I mean, we had Andrew Collins on the show, and we were talking about Göbekli Tepe and you know, the amount of agriculture in that area and animal husbandry, it's mind blowing. It's like overnight, it just explodes, right? It's just mind boggling.
And the same thing is happening at Lake Titicaca, and it's also happening on the exact opposite side of the Earth to Lake Titicaca is Thailand. And in Thailand, rice is being domesticated at the same time that potatoes are being domesticated at Lake Titicaca. Rice is being domesticated exactly the opposite side of the Earth. The same thing, it had been 1,500 miles away from the equator before and ended up 1,500 miles on the other side. It Thailand had actually been in the southern hemisphere and then went to the northern hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
So, but its relationship to the sun was the same. So this is a little oasis area, and that's where rice was domesticated. But also rice was domesticated independently again in other places, in China. So, you know, it seems as though there was there's a hand working here that knows which crops to pick and what ones to try to develop. And rice was independently domesticated two or three times, I think, in India and in Thailand and in China. So you have the same thing happening on the opposite side of the earth. That makes you think that there's something going on here.
Right. You know, we say on this...
And I believe that it was the hand of the Atlanteans giving the giving civilization a reboot. First of all, they had to figure out where they were and where everything was and how the ocean level changed and all that. And that took a lot of their effort. And then they had to get agriculture rebooted again. And they had to get the indigenous people in each of these areas to present them with plants that they could use. They probably didn't have very many plants from Atlantis because they had to leave in a hurry. Now, there are some plants that are very peculiar, that like the avocado, for example, which is a poisonous to all animals except humans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a miraculous. It's almost like a miraculous. If you have high cholesterol, just start eating avocados, and that'll clear it up pretty mm-hmm. good, because it's like a super food. And I think there might be other instances of that. I speculate on that a little bit in Atlantis Beneath the Ice, that there was other ones. But by and large, they were using the local crops, and then they were quickly adapting them so that they could turn into major crops.
Mm-hmm. It's just fascinating. So I want to get your take on the Hall of Records, right? I think when most people, mm-hmm. maybe most people, when they think Atlantis, you know, the Hall of Records does get brought up, and that's been popularized by, you know, Edgar Cayce and the sleeping prophecies mm-hmm. that he brought forth. And, you know, there's been several different locations theorized across the globe. I mean, the most popular from Edgar Cayce is Under the Paw of the Sphinx, which, you know, if our listeners remember last week, we talked to Robert Bouval about that. But, mm-hmm. you know, other areas like the Yucatan and whatnot. So I guess, long story short, my question for you, Rand, is, you know, do you view the Hall of Records as an actual component within this story? Like, is the Hall of Records the technology and the sciences that the Atlanteans were able to gather when they were making their exodus from Antarctica? Or is this mainly myth?
Well, let's put it this way, in a new book I'm coming up with, I'm going into this a little deeper, but I believe that, in the Atlantis Blueprint, there's a chapter called Thoth's Holy Chamber, which I think is the same thing. And in that particular one, I believe that if you draw a line through the three pyramids at Giza, it forms a curve, and it's a Fibonacci curve. That mm-hmm. is, it's conditioned by phi, the universal geometry of phi. And that folds itself onto a circle until it becomes like a seashell. And then the center of the seashell is southeast of the Sphinx, quite a ways. But not so far as that you couldn't walk it from there.
Sure.
And it's probably under the, it could even be under the Nile. So I think it's possible that the Nile was diverted. The three pyramids at Giza were structured to imply a subtle geometry that only advanced people with advanced geometry would be able to see. In other words, I think that the pyramids are actually misdirection. They if you follow the geometry of Giza, it takes you to a location that is to the southeast of the Great Pyramid, and may very well be under the Nile as well. And so, in order to get to it, we might have to divert the Nile and dig there. That's just one theory of that, of course, and we put that forward in the Atlantis Blueprint. I do, however, think, and I'm going into this in the new book a little bit, that there was at least three places on the planet where caches were put.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew the displacement was going to occur. They knew. They had figured out what had happened in the past, and they anticipated that this was going to happen, and they couldn't stop it. But what they could do is they could go into high mountain areas where there's fresh water, places like in the vicinity of Lake Titicaca and also Cusco in that area,
sure,
where you're high above the ocean. You're not going to be hit by tidal waves. And they put, if you like, caches of survival materials there, which could be used to reboot civilization. And my task in this new book is to find the location of them. We mentioned one in the Atlantis Blueprint, which is the one at Cusco.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard the story, the myth there, is that the sun god comes down to Lake Titicaca from the south. He came from the south, that is, from the direction of Antarctica. He landed there at Lake Titicaca, and he gave a device to his son and daughter, and it was a homing device of some sort. It was made of gold. There's various descriptions of what it looked like, but it was something you could carry, and it was made of gold. And the god instructed his son and his daughter to take this until you find a place where it goes into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That will be your home base. So that is what happened when they got to Cusco. The device went into the ground, and they made Cusco their base.
Hmm.
What I'm doing in the new book is explaining why Cusco was selected before the flood as the location to put it, and I think there's up to other ones in the world, at least two other ones in the world that I'm going to be introducing as well.
Fascinating. I can't even imagine preparing for something like that. That'd have to be scary as hell. You know what I mean? Like, just planning for that type of cataclysm. I mean, we see bad stuff happen
really,
all day long.
Well, when you listen to, like, if you take, for example, Noah's Ark, for example, that's the kind of the thing, kind of, it's not like a ship, it's like basically a cork
mm-hmm.
on the water. That's what it is. It's a great big thing that's going to float out there.
Right.
Your best place to be is off-planet. If you can be off-planet,
right,
that's best. If you can't be off-planet, then you want to be in a ship that is, like, survivable, and you don't want to be too near to the shore because you don't want to get crashed in. Or if you were in a submarine, it would be even better. And if there is interesting stories of people like the Haida here in British Columbia have a story of their origins of people coming from a giant clam that came up and landed on the shore, and then the people emerged from the clam. So you know, who knows? When you no longer have words for technology,
right,
because the technology is gone, you can't say it's a submarine. You say
what it looks
like. Big clam.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's, I think that, you know, the idea that I believe that they anticipated it. They did get things rebooted. And then there's this long, dark place where we really don't know from around, 8,000 BC until 4,000 BC. There's like this big gap where we don't know where nothing is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect, but I can't prove, that some of them were still staying on Antarctica in some of the areas that had been polar anyway, because two-thirds of Antarctica was polar even during the time of Atlantis. So they had adapted somewhat to polar conditions for some of their bases.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not impossible. This is sheer speculation. I don't have any evidence for it. But the thing that's making me curious is this big gap between, you know, the destruction of Atlantis, the rise of agriculture, the establishment of the Giza Prime Meridian, and then suddenly nothing.
Right.
Until suddenly the Sumerians show up, completely civilized with hundreds of words, nautical words, in their vocabulary. They're clearly a maritime civilization. They just basically arrive and poof, suddenly we have civilization.
Right.
It's not too long, like 200 years later, we've got the Egyptian civilization. So, you know, it's this mystery of what happened between after the rebooting and then where were they during that time? And I that's kind of an interesting question.
Well, and hopefully as more people become more intrigued with what happened during that epoch, we'll see more people dedicating time and resources to finding evidence of what happened. You know, I love watching online. You know, it seems like every single day we're finding evidence of stuff that's getting older or stuff that we didn't know about yesterday. So it seems like we're just in this flood of new discoveries, and it's such an exciting time to watch.
Oh, just on the news last night, the national news here in Canada, CBC News, the Canadian Broadcasting Company, there was a 15-year-old boy from Quebec. I didn't get his name, and he took his tack from Robert Rouval, who we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to apply the stars, the star systems, to the sacred sites in Mesoamerica, and he was finding that it was working. This guy's 15, and he found one spot.
Right.
Where he thought there should be one, and then he said, and there hadn't been anything, and now they have found something that they believe might very well be there.
Right, and that's an incredible story,
so,
too.
So here you've got a 15-year-old in Quebec doing Robert Beauval stuff in Mesoamerica. Yeah, I think it's going to be a cavalcade of discoveries coming right now.
I would agree. I think we have time for one last question, Rand. You know,
sure.
Recently online, we're seeing all sorts of images and buzz about these Antarctic pyramids. Do you think that this is just outlandish hullabaloo, or do you think that, like, we're finally seeing physical evidence of architecture that was built by the Atlanteans?
Well, I have to be skeptical at this point. Of course, nothing would be dearer to me than if we could find the pyramids on Antarctica. I mean, that would certainly validate the theory I've been spending the last 40 years of my life doing.
Right.
So I have strong motivation to believe that that would be great. However, I'm not yet convinced, I have to say. And when you're looking with Google Maps and you're looking at with things like Atlantis, unless people are actually on the ground there and getting real things, you know, and showing that this is mortar or these are pieces that have been fitted together. Looking at things from the air and stuff like that, you know, you can make a lot of mistakes doing that. People can see things that aren't there. Now, I'm not saying that they aren't there. I'm just saying we have to be, until somebody's actually on the ground and is doing something there on the ground, I have to withhold judgment.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah.
So you had mentioned earlier you have a new book in the works. Can you tell us a little bit about when we can expect that?
Well, it's only going to be an e-book, and it's a collection primarily of stuff that we've written elsewhere, but I've got a couple of new articles, one particularly new article, which is basically should be considered a postscript to the Atlantis blueprint, if you like, because this is the search for these caches of Atlantean caches of material that allowed for the rebooting and trying to locate where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And like I mentioned, the one in Cuzco, there's one in Asia, and there's also another one in the Middle East. So I'm working on that, and that'll be out as probably in a month or so.
Cool.
And it's going to be called From Atlantis to the Promised Land.
Okay. And then do you have any resources online for people to follow your work, like a website, or are you active on social media?
Oh, well, no, actually, I'm really shutting all that kind of stuff down, really, now. I'm going to be folding this into a book. And our website, which I've kept for 20 years, I've now decided that I'd rather do other things with my time. So we're going to package up all our stuff and put it into this book and add a couple of new things. because my interest has turned to fiction now, and so I sort of feel like I'm going to try to finish off all the nonfiction work that I've done this year, and then spend the rest of my what's left of me writing fiction, which I enjoy doing.
Very awesome. Well, hey, Rand, I do appreciate your time today. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I'm so glad we were able to get you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, well, it was a pleasure.
Very good. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's episode of Lost Origins. Hop online at innertraditions.com and you can pick up one of Rand's books. We recommend Atlantis Beneath the Ice. You will not be disappointed. Fascinating read. Make sure that you guys hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode or an article from your friends here at Lost Origins. And make sure that you guys tune in next week when we're going to be talking with Graham Phillips. We're going to be discussing his book surrounding the lost tomb of King Arthur. So definitely an episode you don't want to miss. Until next time, I'm your host, Andrew, and I want you to continue to question everything.